Bad eyes, several Palestinians lose their lives in a fresh bout of violence carried out by the Israeli military in Nablus and Al-Khalil. The Pentagon confirms for the first time that it's supplying Ukraine with anti-radar missiles to use against Russia in the war. And also coming up, China warned separatist forces in Taiwan not to cross its red lines as both sides engage in military drills of their own around the Taiwan Strait. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, four Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Israeli military killed three Palestinians, including a fighter and a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Ibrahim al-Nablusi, in Nablus. A fourth Palestinian was killed during a protest in Al-Khalil. We have more in this following report.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim al-Nablusi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where al-Nablusi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hussein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nablusi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been worrying Israeli military. They carried out a number of shooting against the Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian.
It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim al-Nablusi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
A group of Iranian rights activists have gathered in the capital, Tehran, to condemn Israel's recent aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Stop the massacre, chant these angry protesters who converged on the Palestine Square in Tehran to denounce the latest Israeli aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip, which left 46 Palestinians dead, including 16 children.
We gather today en masse to show our solidarity with Palestinians. We also want to raise awareness of the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people.
We never cease to support our Palestinian brothers and sisters. Why are the world rights entities keeping mum while Israel continues to kill innocent people in Gaza?
Tensions have escalated between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Friday, when Israel carried out airstrikes on cities across the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, killing dozens of people, including two commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. The Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, responded by firing hundreds of rockets towards Israel, putting the Israeli forces on the back foot. Activists here say the Islamic Jihad's show of force has pushed Tel Aviv into calling for a ceasefire, which took effect on Sunday.
In the past, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians would go unanswered. But today, as soon as Israel carries out a strike, the resistance responds immediately with its rockets. So, the era of hit and run is over.
The conflict is the worst outbreak of violence between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Operation Sword al-Quds, an 11-day war last May. The UN Security Council has expressed deep concern over the situation in the Gaza Strip during an emergency meeting held on Tuesday to discuss the Israeli aggression on the besieged territory.
While the UN has expressed its concern over the escalating violence against Palestinians, activists here say this is not enough. They called on the international body to stop paying lip service and take action to keep Israel from further violation of security in the occupied Palestinian territories. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Well, the U.S. says that it has sent anti-radar missiles to Ukraine to help it target Russia's radar systems in the ongoing war between the two neighbors. The Pentagon says the missiles are the high-speed anti-radiation missile, also known as HARM, and were included in the $1 billion in additional military aid package for Kiev. There is no mention of the exact number, but it's the first time the Defense Department has revealed sending the previously undisclosed missile to Ukraine. Ukrainian authorities have not publicly acknowledged receiving or using HARMs, but in recent days, some reports have shown the remains of what appeared to be the fin of a HARM missile that targeted a Russian position in Ukraine. The U.S. has sent $9.8 billion in military aid to Kiev since the launch of Russia's military offensive there in February. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, Britain is mulling contingency plans to deal with possible energy shortages this winter amid tensions between the West and Russia that have led to disruptions in energy markets worldwide. Media reports say Britain is planning scheduled blackouts for industry and households. The government's report predicting worst-case scenarios says the UK might be forced to trigger emergency measures to conserve gas for 4 days in January. The government report says the coming winter electricity capacity shortfall could total about a sixth of peak demand. In such a case, the UK will have to approach Europe for pipeline shipments of gas, but the continent is already facing low supply from Russia. Moscow cites technical and financial problems as the reason for reduced gas exports. The West has placed massive sanctions on Russia, particularly its energy industry. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent, Tamina Taylor, who's joining us from the British capital, London, and we also have journalist, author, and activist, Mr. Farag Hughes, who's joining us from Belfast. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with our very own Amina in London. Amina, how extreme is the crisis going to be? How long will it last? Which sectors are likely to be hit the hardest? And finally, does the government have any contingency plans to deal with this issue?
Well, Badia, the £64,000 question you just rattled off there. In the first instance, let me go to the last thing you asked first in terms of contingency. Well, this is supposed to be the contingency. Having to look at the stats and see very clearly that if the temperature falls in January, which is usually one of the coldest months here, and demand usually rises around that time, because people would have been holding out, knowing full well that extra usage in households meant that, you know, your bills, because of the spiraling fuel and energy crisis that we're in and the cost of living crisis, we're watching the pennies anyway. So households would have really been trying to not use that energy, not put the heaters on full, not do everything to make yourself as warm and comfortable as possible. January would be around the time after Christmas, if you've overspent, that you will be definitely just thinking, right, what else can we do now? So when you're looking at the stats that say there would be a sixth less in terms of what we need in order to get by as a country, so where does the shortfall happen? Where do we kind of try and tighten our belts? Well, industry to have maybe scheduled days off in terms of energy supplies, households to follow suit. This seems to me to be a government that's been caught on the hoof, by consumers who are now having to pick up the pieces for an international policy with Russia that seemingly is not working, and rattle that up with a cost of living crisis that is pushing so many of us to the brink. It's the worst case scenario, Badia. We're talking about less energy for more money for fewer hours of the day, potentially, if this reasonable worst case scenario that the government's outlined here comes to pass. It's absolutely shocking news for so many of us who thought after the interest rate rise and the squeeze on our pockets that the news wouldn't get any worse. And for Britain as a country, I mean, wow, the mighty really is falling. Blackouts, scheduled energy curtailment. I mean, Badia, this is bad news, and it just keeps getting worse.
Frau Hughes, the government is brushing aside concerns, reassuring households and industries that they'll get the electricity and the gas they need, but the Labour Party is criticizing the Tories, saying this is a result of 12 years of their government. Is this only, in your opinion, a settling of political scores, or is the Tory leadership really responsible for failing to prepare for this day?
Well, I think firstly, the Labour leadership and Keir Starmer are no different from the Tory party. I believe very much that if he was in power, we would be in exactly the same position. The Tory Conservative Party are very much in favour of the free market, so they normally would not interfere in, you know, supply and demand issues and the prices that are going up. But I think what we need to sort or separate out are two distinct separate things. There is the shortfall in gas from Norway, potentially, which supplies 60% of the UK's needs during the winter, because they need that gas supply themselves. So that will affect both gas and electricity in the UK. But what we're really seeing is the price hikes in energy that Amina has referred to added to the rise in inflation. And what we're seeing is just mass profiteering from the gas, oil and electricity sectors. This is a mass transfer of wealth from the people who can least afford it to the people who least need it, and that is the shareholders of these huge global corporate companies. I think we're in for a very difficult winter. I believe that this worst case scenario is very much a real case scenario. I think that this has been leaked or put out into the public domain to prepare people for what is going to come in perhaps before Christmas and January and February, when indeed the temperatures drop. But I think the other thing we must keep in mind is the fact that, you know, if Liz Truss becomes the new leader of Britain, the new Prime Minister, and we have Michael Lynch, who is the leader of the RMT Railway Union, what we very well see is a rerun of Margaret Thatcher against Arthur Scargill through Liz Truss and Mick Lynch. And I think there is going to be huge public displeasure at people trying to pay these kind of unmanageable bills. They're talking about £4,200 per year annual bills from December, January 2023. Sure. So I think we're in for a very, very hard winter.
Amina, whoever wins the race for Prime Minister in September will have to deal with the rising food prices, energy shortages, stagflation. Are the two candidates so far clear in their strategies and how they're going to address these problems?
Well, so far in his capacity as Chancellor, as it was only a few weeks ago, Rishi Sunak has tried to throw some money on this issue by offering households a couple hundred quid to try and do what they can here to deal with the cost of living crisis, especially the energy crisis. He has promised to do a little bit more. What that is, he's been very hazy on the details. Liz Truss would not commit in terms of what would happen there. She's already touting tax cuts, which would be incredible to anybody having even the most rudimentary look at Britain's finances right now, after COVID, Brexit, and this new spiraling inflation situation. Where we would find the money for these tax cuts and where they would go is another story altogether. So we're talking here about two candidates who seem to be in fairyland at the moment, because their solutions are so far removed from the needs of the people right now and the very vulnerable in this society who are desperately looking at their finances and wondering, how on earth are we going to make all these things go together? How are we going to have, in a lot of the cases, any kind of rise in your wage is essentially a loss in your wage because of the inflationary pressures. How are we going to make ends meet? And if this government, the two best people they've put forward, have such airy-fairy, non-committal solutions, I mean, we're all looking at a winter of discontent, just to paraphrase a little bit of what Fra mentioned before.
All right, thanks a lot to Dominique Taylor joining us from London, and also thanks to journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes speaking to us from Belfast. Welcome back. China pledges zero tolerance for, quote, separatist activities in Taiwan and warns that it will take the island by force if necessary. China's Taiwan Affairs Office has issued a white paper laying out economic and military measures with regards to the self-ruled island. That's as both sides engage in military drills and shows of strength. Footages show Chinese jets flying while Navy ships patrolling around the island and the strategic Taiwan Strait. The Chinese Army, however, says the drill is focused on blockades and resupply logistics to refine joint containment and control capabilities. China has carried out a set of naval and air drills near Taiwan since last week. Maneuvers followed a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Taiwan has also mobilized its air and land patrols and deployed land-based missile systems. China claims Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing nexus with the United States. And the Iranian Ministry of Information and Communication says it has received the first data from the Khayyam satellite hours after it was launched into space from a base in Kazakhstan. The ministry says the data was received at the Iranian Space Agency's Mohdasht base Khayyam aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket. Was blasted off from Baikonur Cosmodrome on Tuesday. This is a remote sensing satellite that will send high-quality pictures four times a day for use in environmental and agricultural researches and monitoring of water resources. Isa Zarepour, Iranian Minister of Communications and Information Technology, says the launch is the beginning of a strategic cooperation between Tehran and Moscow in the field space. Russia also put an Iranian satellite into space back in 2005. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Qom Province, with an area of nearly 15,000 square kilometers, occupying less than 1% of the entire territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The province is linked to Tehran Province in the north, to Save, Tafresh, Ashtian, and Dilijan in Markazi Province in the south. It lies to the southeast of Isfahan, and from the east to Kabir Valley and Namak Lake. About one-fifth of the province is covered with mountains and foothills, with the remaining four-fifths a large valley or basin. The holy city of Qom is situated in the center of the province, close to the surrounding towns of Salafjagan, Khalajistan, Kahak, and Jafariya. Given its historic structures, discoveries of artifacts, and the recordings of historical documents, Qom was a reputable and relatively large city in the pre-Islamic era. When Islam was introduced to Iran, Qom developed rapidly and became semi-autonomous during the sovereign reign of the Bani Umayyad and Bani Abbas caliphates. Qom is home to the heavenly court, the historic mausoleum, and shrine of Hazrat Ma'sumeh. Also known as Fatimeh Ma'sumeh, the daughter of Imam Musa Kazim, the seventh Imam of Shia Islam. Hazrat Ma'sumeh is revered by Muslims worldwide, and so her resting place being in Qom lifted the dignity and status of the city and conferred religious significance upon it. Among the other notable tourist attractions in the province are the holy Jamkaran Mosque and more than 400 other Imamzades, offspring of imams, shrines, seminaries, theological schools, historically important mosques such as Friday, Imam Hassan, Babul Jannah, and Raf'at, educational and international institutes, and Qomrud Lay. When the 7th Abbasid Caliph Ma'mun invited Imam Reza to Marv, Hazrat Ma'sumeh moved to Iran in the company of a number of Shia Muslims to meet with and join Imam Reza. But just outside Qom, she was taken ill. In her 80s at the time, she was bedridden in Qom for 17 days before she passed away. Her body was buried in a well-respected place in the city of Bagh Babylon. Today, Bagh Babylon is famous because of Hazrat Ma'sumeh's shrine that houses a magnificent monument. This stately edifice is one of the most important religious shrines of the Islamic world. The original shrine was built in the middle of the 3rd century Islam and was expanded substantially between the 4th and 6th centuries when a dome and artwork were added to it. Qom Azam Mosque, located right next to Hazrat Ma'sumeh's mausoleum, is the city's Azam Mosque, known widely as Ayatollah Burujerdi's Azam Mosque. It was built in 1918 through the efforts of Sayyid Hossein Tabotabai Burujerdi. The architect of this splendid monument was a man named Hossein Lorzadeh. It is classified among the 3 largest veranda mosques. Its dome stands at 24 meters high. Today, the mosque is the Qom Seminary's most important teaching center. The mosque is now merged with Hazrat Ma'sumeh's shrine. Recently, its dome was adorned with large thin flakes of lusterware, donated and produced under the supervision of Haj Hassan Jaber Ansari. The Tabotabai Mosque, spearheaded by Hujjatul Islam Agha Muhammad Tabotabai, the son of Ayatollah Haj Agha Hussein Qomi, a great mosque with an elevated dome was built adjacent to Hazrat Ma'sumeh's mausoleum. Famously known as the Tabotabai Mosque, it was built between 1981 and 1991. In the 10th century Islamic era, Shah Tahmasp Safavi used bricks to build the first sepulcher on the mosque. Sometime later, an additional sepulcher made of transparent white steel was installed around the original sepulcher, and a wooden door was fitted in the northern frontage. In the 13th century Islamic era, Fath Ali Shah Qajar replaced this door with a luxurious golden door. He also upgraded the sepulcher by having it coated with layers of silver and installed on a malachite pillar. With time, the sepulcher lost its radiance, so in the 14th century in Islamic era, it was again renovated. Finally, in 1973, the form of the sepulchers was altered and its height increased. Fath Ali Shah Qajar had the shrine flagstone with marble. He believed the spiritual gusts around Hazrat Masume's shrine has to step on the best of stones. Atiq Courtyard. In the 10th century in the Islamic era, Shah Begum Khatun, the daughter of Shah Ismail Safavi, built a square-form courtyard with three verandas. Later, Fath Ali Shah had it remodeled into an irregular octagonal shape. This octagonal form is said to have been built on the memorial of Imam Reza Thamanul Hujaj, the brother of this holy woman, pointing to the fact that Imam Reza was the 8th Shia Imam. Gradually, the number of verandas in the courtyard increased. At the moment, it has 7 of them, 4 on the south side and 3 on the north. The verandas of the Atiq courtyard are the most famous within this court. They were built on the order of Shah Begum and gilded during the reign of Fath Ali Shah Qajar. They constitute the entrance of the heavenly courtyard. Atop each veranda, a hadith inscription in white thulf is displayed on an azure background. Above it, a myriad of tiles and inscriptions. Thank you. Imam Khomeini Great Sanctuary. It is one of the greatest architectural feats after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, featuring a multitude of porches, entrances, and other facilities. Called Balasar, overhead mosque, it is situated nearby and overhead to Hazrat Masumeh's shrine. That's where it draws its name. In the Safavid period, it served as a motel. Inside the shrine and next to the holy tomb of Hazrat Masumeh, a mausoleum houses the eternal resting places of grand ayatollahs, scholars, and outstanding scientific and religious figures, the largest grouping of revered Muslims anywhere, particularly in the Shia world. Qum is called Darul Aman. Some of the renowned and compassionate scholars buried in the mausoleum here are Allamas Tabatabai, Khansari, Golpayegani, and Behjet. Martyr of love and writing and eminent ideologist Murtaza Mutahhari is also buried here. In the INM mirror courtyard of the Holy Shrine lies the mausoleum of freedom crusader Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri, born in 1843 and killed in 1909. Sheikh Nuri's memorial is symbolic among the liberal crusaders of constitutionalism. This is the tomb of martyr Ayatollah Dr. Mufatteh. He was born in 1889 and martyred in 1939. The Faizia Theological School was founded in the Middle Ages of Islamic history and is located in Qom next to Hazrat Masumeh Shrine in Astan-e-Muqaddase, Holy Threshold Square. It was registered as a National Heritage in 2007. Astana School was replaced by Faizia School in the first half of the 13th Islamic century. According to valid historical documents, the school was established in the middle of the 6th Islamic century and was renovated in the Safavid era. The two-story building features four verandas. The 40 chambers on the first floor were built in the Qajar period, and the other 40 on the second floor were built in the 14th Islamic century. The oldest part of the seminary is where the southern veranda is and is decorated with beautiful tiles belonging to the Safavid era of 1939 AH. It is regarded as the gateway to the Atir courtyard and Hazrat Masumeh's shrine. The Museum of Astan-e-Muqaddase, the Holy Threshold, is one of the oldest in the country, constructed in 1935 inside the Holy Shrine of the Martyr Mutahhari Mosque. Its curatorial activities continued until 1974. Located in Astana Square, the museum building was built a couple of years after the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Originally, it covered an area of 500 square meters, but in 1992, The building's basement was added to the museum, increasing its total usable area to 1,000 square meters. The oldest Quran in the museum dates back to 819 AD, and bears the name of Ma'mun Abbasi on the first page. Some of the Qurans are written on animal skin, some on fabric, and the rest on paper. The collection within the museum has various parts and includes handwritten Qurans from the second Islamic century to those written in the contemporary period, coins from Islamic and pre-Islamic eras, painted tabloids and miniatures, wooden works of art including marquetry and parquetry, terracotta, bowls, glass bowls and golden inlaid tiles with designs and beautiful inscriptions belonging to the 6th and 8th Islamic centuries, stone masonry works and decorative stones, metal instruments and engravings, hand-woven silk carpets from the Safavid and Qajar eras, and hand-woven fabric. Samples of expensive marquetry are kept in the Museum of Ostane Muqaddase in Rome. One such sample is a rare marquetry door belonging to the Qajar period, built when Nasiruddin Shah Qajar was in power and Mirza Taghi Khan Amir Kabir was vizier, and forms part of the tomb of Muhammad Shah Qajar. Another marquetry piece from the Qajar period, with inscriptions of famous poems by Muhtasham Kashani describing Ashura in Nastaliq calligraphy, are engraved beautifully on bones. The Chehel Akhtaran Shrine in Qom. The mausoleum of Musa Mubarqa, son of Imam Muhammad Taghi, and other offspring of the Imam. That's why the large courtyard of this collection contains three popular shrines, the Musa Mubarqa, the Chehel Akhtaran, and the Imamzade Zayd. The monument was built in 1571. Ordered by Shah Tahmasp Safavid, it was designed by Master Sultan Rumi, who was amongst the most famous architects of the Safavid era. His name is recorded in the shrine. In 1574 AD, the building's roof was renovated with brick. The ceiling is very high. A number of Sayyids and offspring of Imams are buried here. They include the sons and offspring of Imam Musa Mubarak. It is said that a total of 40 men, 40 women, and 25 children are entombed in this shrine. The library of Ayatollah Marashi Najafi. Sayyid Shahabuddin Husseini Marashi Najafi was born in 1897 in Najaf and passed away in 1990 at the age of 93. He led a frugal existence. He is famous for salvaging thousands of rare and lost Islamic books at his own expense. His library holds the world's largest collection of Shia manuscripts. The oldest undated manuscript in this library is the pages of the Holy Quran written in Kufi, going back to the 2nd and 3rd Islamic centuries. And the oldest dated manuscript is two parts of the Quran written in Kufi by Ali ibn Hilal in Baghdad in 1013. There is also a golden page of the Holy Quran in the collection bearing Imam Reza's handwriting. Now the manuscripts of the library number 60,000, 65% of them in Arabic and the rest in Persian, Turkish, Urdu, Tartari, Hibachi, Pahlavi, and Latin. Annually, between 750 and 1,000 manuscripts are added to this library. Marashi Najafi wrote more than 148 books, dissertations, and papers in his lifetime. Most of them are yet to be published. Qom's traditional bazaar, scented with perfumes, has played host to travelers from far and wide who come here to buy souvenirs such as sohan, mohrs, prayer stones, and sajadehs or prayer mats. The aroma of fresh sohan, made next to the retail shops, draws every tourist and pilgrim to itself. Qom's Grand Bazaar houses a beautiful historical monument, located near the mausoleum of Hazrat Masumeh. It bears the hallmarks of the Qajar era architectural style and was registered as a National Heritage Site in 1997. The building has two floors with 12 chambers. It used to have long cloth sashes that are now mostly ruined. Above the chambers and the vaulted corners is chalk architecture. The roof of the shopping center has three openings and the middle section opens up to a height of 15 meters. The market has an arched roof, considered the largest in Iran. The monument was designed and executed by Master Hussein Qomi in 1882. Custodianship of the monument was granted to Sayyid Mahmud Tabatabai, a recognized businessman in Qom and the father of Sayyid Hussein Tabatabai. The mosque in the old square of Qom is 900 years old. And atop its fine architecture is the first minaret and dome built in Iran, and the third in the Islamic world. It is an octangular-shaped monument with a dome and two pyramid-shaped covers on top. It was built during the rule of the Qajar dynasty at the beginning of the 18th Islamic century. Later, a veranda and some other monuments were added to it. The shrine of Imam Ali ibn Ja'far, after Astana Muqaddase, transcends all other monuments and mausoleums of Qom province in terms of spectacular decorations. One of the most important features of this splendid shrine is its plasterwork, which is among the most outstanding artistic works of the 8th Islamic century. There are 94 pieces of gold inlaid tiles on the monument showing plant, animal, and human designs. Naskh inscriptions containing Quranic verses and religious stories and Persian literature are among other unique decorations of the shrine, while other inscriptions and decorations are common throughout Iran and in museums around the world. The gold inlaid altar of this monument, situated at the southern end of the shrine, was built in 734 AH. It is one of the greatest artistic works of its time. Today, this altar has pride of place at the Islamic Era Museum in Iran's National Museum. Jamkaran Mosque, where Shia Muslims believe that Muhammad al-Mahdi, the hidden 12th Imam, who will lead the world to an era of universal peace, once appeared and offered prayers. The mosque is located on the Qom-Kashan Road, 6 kilometers outside the city of Qom. According to Muhaddith Nuri, a contemporary religious scholar, the foundation of this mosque is credited to a man named Hassan ibn Muthle Jamkarani, who was contracted to build the mosque upon the request of the 12th Imam. On Wednesday evenings, and especially on the 15th night of Sha'ban, Imam Zaman's birthday, Shia Muslims come here to pray. Imam Hassan Askari Mosque, also located in Qom near Ali Khani Bridge and next to Astana Street, is the monument of the 11th Shia Imam Hassan Askari. It used to be called the Atiq Friday Prayer Mosque. According to various accounts, it was built by the Imam's representative, Ahmad ibn Ishaq Ash'ari, in the 3rd Islamic century. Since then, this monument has been renovated several times. Today, the oldest part of the monument is its southern veranda, built in 1750. The Imam Hassan Mosque has always been held in high esteem. Since the 9th Islamic century, the custodians of Astana Muqaddase have been taking care of this mosque. Rebuilt in the final years of the Safavid period, today only the southern veranda remains standing. The monument sustained extensive damage during the Qajar era flooding. At the end of Qom's Chahar Mardan Street and inside a small garden called Baghe Gombad-e-Sabz, the Green Dome Garden, there are three historical monuments, relics from the 8th Islamic century. It is known as the Kashan Entrance. According to available historical documents, the two domes of this site are the tombs of the rulers of the Ali Safi House, independent sovereigns of Qom. The inscription on the third dome has been destroyed, so no one knows when it was made and who made it. But going by documents from various sources, this third dome, historically speaking, dates back to the same period and probably also belongs to one of the members of the Ali Safi House. The people of Qom call this collection of mausoleums Sa'd, Sa'id, and Mas'ud, the three senior Ash'ari Arabs that revitalized Qom during their time. The plaster work at these three monuments is one of a kind. 1. The tomb tower of Khaje Asiluddin, representing the tomb of two rulers of the Safi house in 761 AH. 2. The tomb tower of Khaje Ali Sali, representing the tomb of three rulers of the Safi house in 792 AH. And 3. The northern tomb tower belonging to the late 8th and early 9th Islamic centuries. The tombs at the Green Dome Garden were registered on the National Heritage List in 1931. The tomb towers located in the garden include a southern dome, a middle dome, and a northern dome. From among the valuable remembrances of Persian architecture are the old caravanserais, built in the past eras in a different communicative, economic, military, geographical, and religious environment, and then gradually over time developed and expanded. 2 kilometers from Mahmudabad village stands a clay castle on the edge of Qom Road. In the north of the village there are 2 castles, one a famous stone castle and Islamic monument, and the other called the clay castle is made of mud. It is located north of Safed Kuh, White Mountain, in the lower northern region of Qom province. According to collected documents, this castle dates back to the Ashkani era and was inhabited in successive historical periods. The castle is 45 meters long and 29.5 meters wide, with walls of various heights but not higher than 10 meters. The castle may have served as a protective outpost monitoring travelers entering via Varamin and the fringe of Ray into the Qom district. It would have been portrayed as the landmark entrance to the city. Stone Caravanserai. This caravanserai is located on the Qom Road, 35 kilometers from Qom City. It is a 4-veranda caravanserai which lies in ruin and belongs to the Safavid period. The construction material used is mainly stone and has 4 semicircle shaped towers on the western and eastern sides. Qom owes most of its global recognition to the holy shrine of Hazrat Masumeh, which glitters like a diamond sitting in the middle of the city and every year attracts a large number of pilgrims. It is the smallest province of Iran, but is conveniently situated on the main interstate highway linking several major cities. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. We express our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javedan. Stay tuned. On the day of Ashura, when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was reconfirming his allegiance to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the angel of victory was flying over his head in the heavens. Even this angel could help Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to reach victory on the spots in the battlefield. However, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam had a firm covenant with Allah, and his martyrdom could save the humanity. Karbala,
as I step onto your sands, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed here beneath.
In my words, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and Allah signed a treaty, and Imam al-Hussein never tried to violate such a divine treaty. He was faithful to Allah up to an extent that his head went on spears for his goals and mission. The head of the grandson of Prophet Muhammad went on spears, and this was among the first times that this incident happened. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam made a covenant with Allah, and after being slaughtered, he went to Allah to witness him. This is how great Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura,
thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javedan. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
New year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. دولين كربلاء What precious blood was spilled there عاشورا الحسين was murdered here عاشورا الحسين was murdered here
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.